Crime, Wine, and Chaos contains adult language and graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
We're ready for our close-up, Chaos Kids. I'm Naomi.
I'm Amber. And this is Crime, Wine, and Chaos. Oh. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm close-up ready today, sister.
You're always close-up ready. What are you talking about?
That's so nice of you. All I did was...
You're like one of those people like mom who doesn't like go get the mail without their face on, right?
I'll get the mail.
It
depends on what I'm doing for the day, you know. How are you?
I'm still picking popcorn out of my teeth a little bit. Sorry.
Like
a rest of the night endeavor. I'm going to keep finding little, you know, what it is with popcorn. You know what? Nothing. There's nothing new with me. Absolutely.
Great.
I got nothing for you.
What do I have? Oh, if you're in the Seattle area, my band Tinfoil Top Hat is playing in the Shanghai Room on June 13th, which is in the Green Lake area. Pretty excited about that. I've never been there. That's a cute little neighborhood.
Yeah. Right on. Did you say in Greenwood?
Greenwood, Green Lake. Are those the same?
No, they're very different.
Okay. Well, it's near Green Lake.
Oh, near Green Lake. Okay.
Cool. Yeah. Tell me where the Greenwood neighborhood is. Why do I not know this when I've lived in Seattle my whole life?
Greenwood is that neighborhood, like you're going to the north end, Dix. It's like north of Ballard.
Oh, okay. Okay. Gotcha. Ballard's such a cool town, but it's a pain in the butt to get to.
It's north of Ballard and like inland from... What's that neighborhood that's like right on the water there north of Ballard? You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-mm. No, clearly not. Is it Greenwood? I don't know.
No.
Shit. I'm not very familiar with that area. I should be. Anyway, so that's happening.
Great. That's exciting. What are you drinking?
Thank you for asking. I'm drinking 14 Hands Hot to Trot. It's a red blend from Columbia Winery.
Okay. So... Three pants, seven somethings last week.
Sure.
And now four hands.
And a partridge in a pear tree.
And a partridge in a pear tree. Okay.
That's correct. That's correct.
Great. Great.
Do you want some crime?
Always.
I mean, you don't want crime, but do you want to hear some crime?
Yes. Let's hear some crime. Let's hear
All right. I've got one for you. We're going to 1991 in San Diego.
Okay.
And it is March 30th, and 21-year-old Jessica Bergsten has been missing for a little over a week. She had only lived in San Diego for less than a month.
Oh, my God.
I know.
This is like...
The girl in New Zealand. Yeah. Like when you're new. Like
that lady, the gal in Lubbock, who was the suitcase killer. She'd been there for like a month.
Do you think I feel like this when I'm either like in a new spot or on vacation, I have like a false sense of security.
When it's new?
Yeah.
Why? What do you think?
I'm not sure.
You don't know what's dangerous or scary there yet?
Maybe. I don't know. So Jessica had previously lived in Arizona. She had moved to San Diego just to start a new chapter of life. You know, she's just like, why not? So police check her phone records and bank statements. They don't really find anything. And her parents get the news and they head to San Diego to help look for her.
Just that whole thing where like it's happening to your kid or your spouse or whatever. And they're like a different state or a different country than you. The traveling to.
I know.
It's just an extra layer, you know, it's just an extra layer of like stress and work and.
I know. I always think of Arpena and her parents having to come from India.
Yeah.
Like I can't even imagine that flight. You want to be able to just beam yourself there right away. Yeah. Oh, God. So at this time, they're still hopeful that she just like went somewhere and didn't tell anyone, you know, not thinking the worst just yet. So they get to San Diego, they make a bunch of flyers and start putting them up all over the city. So Brandy McCain was Jessica's good friend. The two had met 8 years prior when Brandy's family moved from Yuma, Arizona to Tucson, Arizona, where Jessica and her family lived. So this would have made them like early junior high, seventh grade, maybe.
Okay.
And the two girls hit it off right away. And Jessica's parents loved Brandy. They treated her like another one of their kids. Brandy's parents had just gotten divorced. And so she was being raised by a single mom who worked a lot. So she would like be at Jessica's house a lot. Even on school nights, she would stay for dinner, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
In 1987, Brandy and Jessica were both 17 years old when they went to a skateboarding party.
A skateboarding party?
It was like a hangout at like an outdoor like skate. It had like the half.
Like a half pipe?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah.
It was at this party where they first met Mark Rogowski, who went by Gator.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. He was extremely charismatic and like a really fucking good skater. Really good.
Those fucking skater boys, dude. Mm-hmm. Every fucking time. Those mm-hmm. fucking skater boys. And they always had like a whole bunch of like bangs. Like a whole yes. bunch of bangs hanging down half the side of their face. Mm-hmm. You could only see one of their eyes.
Or just like a mop top. Like a uh-huh. messy on purpose kind of uh-huh. vibe. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. So Brandy describes this night as magical. The first night yeah, of yeah. meeting Mark. Yeah. Oh yeah. my God. I can just put myself there. And this would change the trajectory of both of their lives forever. So
okay.
By 1988, Gator was an international icon and a celebrity in the skating community. So while still in her teenage years, I think she was either 18 or 19, Brandy and Mark start dating, and Brandy moves in with Mark in California. And this is kind of when Brandy and Jessica lost touch. So she moved out of Arizona to live with Mark in California, and they just kind of...
Well, yeah, I mean, it's still the 80s. We don't have cell phones. We don't have internet. So we're not emailing mm-hmm. each other or texting each other. Like, there's no FaceTime. It's a lot harder. I mean, you have, like, landline, and, like, that's it. Or, like, literal snail mail. Like, that's it.
Totally. Totally. Right. Yep.
So, I mean, I remember, you remember, right? Like when we were kids, if somebody moved away, like it was they like, were gone
never
forever.
Never see you again.
Yeah. That was it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I feel like I might have an inkling about this story, actually, because this is sounding vaguely familiar, but I don't like know the story. I think I know of the story, but anyway.
Probably do. Yeah.
Keep going. Also, by the way, like, isn't everybody's life changed forever once they start hanging out with the skaters? Like that's.
Mine was.
Oh, right.
I mean, started a whole QFC click.
Yes, exactly.
Based on that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so she moves to California. She moves in with Gator. He's at the height of his career right now. So within his friend group of skaters are Tony Hawk, Steve Catalero, and Christian DeSoy.
Okay.
Brandy says the two appeared to be a golden couple to everybody else, her and Mark, but things were very, very different behind closed doors.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. She said that Gator became very controlling as soon as the two started living together. And she said that, you know, Mark had this charismatic skater persona, which was Gator, but then Mark was who he really was at home with her, right? Totally. Right.
Of course.
Uh-huh. She said he would get out of control and mad over very small things. And when he would get like this, his eyes would change. Mm-hmm. I've heard so many people say this, and I'm trying to think if I've ever seen it.
I mean, I think I've seen it on some men.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I also wonder how much like drugs and alcohol are playing a part in all this.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. Like at right. least... In my skater circles, lots of drugs and alcohol were involved.
Mm-hmm. Me know? Too. But a lot of pot where people were just like mellow, not like angry.
I mean, it really depended on the night, you know?
That's true. That's true. I mean, if your car fills up with gnats, like... that will piss someone off. No, he was so kind and mellow.
Okay, nothing. I've never had anything bad happen on psychedelics.
Except the gnat invasion.
There was the gnat. That was the one thing. Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. Okay, so Mark is an ass. So she said it was really obvious that he had some deep issues inside of him. And Brandy finally moves out and ends the relationship after Mark became so angry one day that he locked her in a closet. And she was like, yeah, I'm fucking out of here.
Okay.
Yep. Then, so we're just going to, this is just a quick blurb. April of 1991. So this is about 3.5 weeks since Jessica has been missing. And a family is hiking in a desert in California and they come upon a human skeleton.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. But the body is so badly decomposed that they can't even tell if it's male or female. It's picked up and taken to, you know, the lab and kind of just is sitting there as a Jane Doe.
Right.
So Mark, in the meantime, has befriended a local surfer and minister named Augie.
I'm sorry. A surfing minister? Okay. Oh, my God.
I thought of about 100 dorky things that I could say in that moment and then decided against it.
Okay.
Something to do with righteous and like waves, but also our savior.
Yes.
Okay. So Augie, Augie's on the scene and Mark immediately starts picking Augie's brain about religion. And Augie said it was obvious that Mark is clearly looking for some answers and purpose in his life. Like he's struggling, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he says that the first time he went to Mark's house to talk to him about the Lord, he noticed that Mark had a lot of what? Talk to him about the Lord. You know, these are back-to-back episodes of a lot of Jesus.
There's a lot of Jesus.
There's been a lot of Jesus going on up in here. God damn it. So he's at Mark's house telling him about Jesus. And Mark, Augie said that Mark had a lot of just dark shit in his house. He had a pretty robust collection of rape porn.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's during the breakup with Brandy that Mark first turned to Augie, you know, because he really wants to get his anger under control. And I don't know if he thinks he's going to win Brandy back or if he just felt like, you know, I did this to myself and blah, 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 and I need to make right. I don't know. So he's going through it. So the two young men had a lot in common and they talked a lot about addiction and childhood trauma, you know, and surfing and skating is kind of similar crowd. So they just really clicked and became besties. And their friendship became like really, really deep. So about 5 months into this friendship, Mark tells Augie that he wants to get rid of his porn collection because he knows that it isn't healthy for him. And he wants Augie to, you know, be there with him. Like it's a big deal. So Augie goes to his house and when Mark is doing this, he gets a, like a closer look at some of these videos that he has. And they're like way more fucked than he initially thought. Like a lot of them are like bloody and like murdery.
Oh no.
Yeah. So a year after the breakup, Brandy is living with her parents in Southern California when Mark comes by to visit her. She said that he was talking all about how he found the Lord, et cetera, et cetera. But then also, like, just as quickly as before, he fucking flipped and said that he could kill her and take her body to the desert and that nobody would ever find her.
Oh.
Yeah. You know, it's people like Mark are like, they're just white knuckling it through trying to be normal, you know?
Right. Right. Totally.
Like, that's what it looks like to me.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Because you can't even get through like a quick visit after not seeing her for a year before the, right, the mask falls away and you're right back to,
right,
you know, oh God. So she's like, yeah, no, I'm good. You can keep it moving. Right.
She said, yeah.
Yeah. She said that he was super fucking erratic and scaring her and she asked him to leave. And a few days after this, Brandy came home from work one day and everything that Mark had bought her was missing, including her car.
What?
Yeah. Her room had been ransacked and like he had like broken a bunch of picture frames, just like it was a shit hot mess. So she filed a police report and a few days after filing it, the police called her and told her that they had found her car with all the things in it and had been set on fire in the desert.
Oh, Jesus fucking Christ. This fucking guy.
This fucking guy sucks. Mm-hmm. So while all of this is going on, Mark is still hitting Jesus studies hard, right? And one evening, Augie and Mark are handing out youth group cards at the 7-Eleven, and Augie notices the missing person flyer in the window for Jessica. And he took the flyer and put it in his Bible so that he would remember to pray for her and her family later.
Oh, my God.
I know. This is just dark. A week later, Mark and Augie are doing Bible study. And the study that night was about Judas Iscariot.
Iscariot.
Why do you know this? You're so biblical.
Judas is the one who turned in Jesus.
Mm-hmm. That's why I just know Judas Priest.
If somebody calls you a Judas, they're calling you a traitor because Judas took like 9 pieces of silver in exchange for turning in Jesus to the Roman soldiers or whoever that came and took him away and took him to the cross.
Yeah, I have that whole explanation here. So I'll just go to the next paragraph. Sorry. Well, I'm really impressed. I fully Googled. Because Augie, in this documentary I was watching, was just like, we're learning about Judas. And I'm like, pause, Google, Judas.
Did I get it right? I think
this is what the Google said. Judas is known as the great pretender. He had betrayed Jesus for silver. And when he realized what he had done, he hung himself.
Oh, even, I didn't know that part. But
you almost said even better.
I mean, he sent the Lord's son to his death. I mean, he came back or whatever, so it's fine. But, you know, he bummed a lot of people out for 3 days, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was the study topic for the evening. So Bible study wraps up, Mark goes home, and then much, much later that night, like Augie and his wife are in bed, and he gets a knock at his front door. And when he answers it, Mark is on his front porch, and he is absolutely sobbing. And he said, I am Judas, and I can never be a Christian. Yeah.
Okay.
So Augie asked him what he did. Did you hurt someone? And Mark tells him to go get his Bible. And when he does, Mark pulls out the flyer of Jessica and he says, I raped her and I killed her and I buried her in the desert.
I mean, I kind of saw that coming, but shit, man.
Yeah. Okay. Augie, even though he's like kind of dorky and like super Jesus-y, like my heart was just breaking for this guy because he was talking about like, I didn't know what to do. Like I wanted to just like clobber him and like kill him myself. But I figured that what he needed was to be held and loved. Oh, so that's what I did.
Oh my God.
I know.
Yes, this is the story that I thought that it was. Like I said, only vaguely familiar with this series of events. But okay, just to be clear, because Jessica had moved to San Diego, but these guys, like these skater dudes, they were all in LA, right?
I think so at this point, yes.
Right. So when Brandy moved in with Mark and like he was in California with Tony Hawk and all these other guys, like being like skate heroes, like they were in LA. That's right.
After the San Diego party, they never really, I'm not really sure because I know that Jessica had moved to San Diego, but it just said Southern California.
Maybe they're okay.
Which is, could be many places.
Right. Well, I mean, it is just one giant concrete jungle all the way from like Santa Monica to like, you know, the end of Orange County, like, you know, however many, it's just goes on and on and on and on. So,
right.
All one big area. Anyway, sorry.
That's okay. So Mark tells Augie this. Augie tells him that they need to go to the police and he needs to confess. But right after he said that, because Augie lived right next to train tracks and the little train intersection thing started to come down, like a train was coming, and Mark goes bolting towards the train tracks like he's going to jump in front of the train. And Augie runs after him in his underwear and tackles him to the street and keeps him from jumping in front of the train. And then that's when he held him while he cried. And he was like, I wanted to push him in front of the train or kill him or beat him. But he held him in his underwear on the road. Okay, so. Oh, oh, so right now they're in Carlsbad.
Okay.
Okay, so Augie convinces Mark to go to the Carlsbad police and confess. When Mark calls the police, he said that he killed Jessica in his home 2 months prior. So police head straight to Mark's house, and of course it looks like nothing happened there. But when the police spray it with luminol, the carpet in the living room was completely lit up, and it was obvious that there was a lot of blood. He then takes the police to the location where he dumped Jessica's body, which has since been recovered. So they're finally able to identify the skeletal remains that had been logged as Jane Doe as Jessica. And they call Jessica's family and tell them that they had a positive match for her. I know. Which I don't know, like, I'm not, who knows? This is like, what, 1991. I don't know what the system was like then, but it's like you have a missing woman and then a skeleton is found. I'm not sure why there wasn't.
Maybe they were too far away from each other.
Maybe. I don't know.
Like where she was reported missing and where she was found.
Yeah. Yeah. So then Brandy gets a call from a friend and he like right away, he's like, I'm so sorry. And Brandy doesn't know what he's referring to.
Oh, fuck.
I know. And that is when she learns that Mark had confessed to killing Jessica.
Oh my God.
This poor woman. Yeah. She later learned that a year after the two lost touch, Jessica, so it looks like she moved in with Mark. That lasted for about a year. And then it's been a year since they broke up. So 2 years since she's been friends with Jessica or talked to her. And she didn't realize that Jessica had moved back to San Diego. And when she got there, she reached out to Mark because that was the only person that she knew in the area. And so Brandy just feels really, really guilty because she never had a friendship with Jessica after dating Mark. And Jessica had no idea that he was fucking dangerous at all.
Right.
She just knew that she met him when she was 17 and...
Right.
Yeah. So she just, Brandy said that even if Jessica called her and said, oh yeah, I'm just going to have lunch with Mark and catch up, that she would have told her no, like run the other way. Don't.
Right. Do that.
Yeah. So in Mark's confession, he said that he was still really angry at Brandy when Jessica called him. She said, yeah, that she was in town and asked if he wanted to get together. So they hung out at his apartment and had wine and smoked some weed. He said that he was just about to take her home when he changed his mind and started attacking her. He said that he tied her up and hit her in the head with a metal bar, trigger warning for sexual assault. He then raped her in every possible way for the next several hours.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. She was still alive, and he said that Jessica was making too much noise. So he took his surfboard out of the surfboard bag and put Jessica in the bag and zipped it up.
Alive?
Yep. But she kept screaming. So Mark put his hand over her mouth through the bag and suffocated her to death. This poor woman. He said that even though he was angry at Brandy because Jessica was her friend, that was the next best thing.
I have no words.
I have no words either. He entered a plea of guilty to first degree murder and rape. And on March 6, 1992, he was sentenced to 31 years to life in prison. He has been denied parole several times. There was actually one time where twice where he was granted parole and the governor overturned the parole grant. As of November 2023, he is still incarcerated in Donovan State Prison.
I wonder if Jessica's parents have something to do with that.
Yeah.
Like writing to the governor and asking him to override that.
Yeah. I can't even imagine just like some dude that you met once when you were 17 and you're like, well, I'm new to town. I don't know anybody. So like, let's reconnect. And then that fucking happens. What the fuck, dude?
I mean, we knew some people when we were 17 that turned out to be really bad people.
Mm-hmm.
It happens. Yeah,
it does happen.
Oh my God. That's crazy pants.
I know.
And was he still like famous skater mm-hmm. guy when this all went down? Yes. That's what I thought. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Can you imagine?
No.
It's insane.
What a waste.
I mean, he clearly has like major issues, right? Like major issues.
Mm-hmm. Like, but we've talked so many times before too about people who just have so much potential. Tony Hawk went on to have video games made after him, a whole skateboard brand. I mean,
he's a household name.
Yes. And Gator was on the same trajectory and just, what the fuck?
Well, he was not well.
Nope, he was not.
Poor Jessica. Poor Brandy.
She's still not okay. She feels like it's all her fault.
Oh, I know. I mean, I know. I can imagine she does, but it's like, oh, honey, we do not take on the responsibility of shitty fucking men. That is not.
Absolutely not. That is not ours to own. But the guilt too of like being so wrapped up in your shitty man that you let your friendships fall to the wayside. And
I mean, that is a legitimate thing to feel bad about. That's the only part
when you're that young. We all do it.
And not only that, but like I said, it was the fucking late 80s, early 90s. It was not like today. It was so much harder back then to stay.
Oh, I know. I'm sure if it was today's time, she would have been texting her like, this guy sucks, you know?
Yeah. They would have been in touch the whole time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So sad.
Wow. Sister. Well, mm-hmm. Thanks for that.
You're welcome.
How about some chaos?
Is this going to be a palate cleanser or no?
Face says no.
I'm going to tell you about R. Bud Dwyer. Have you ever heard of him? Mm-mm. Okay. So Robert Bud Dwyer was born November 21st, 1939 in St. Charles, Missouri. He graduated with an AB in political science and accounting from Allegheny College in Meadville, Pennsylvania in 1961. He was part of a fraternity, you know? Normal dude. Mm-hmm. He went on to earn a master's in education in 1963, the same year he married his wife, Joanne, and they had two kids. He taught social studies and coached football at Cambridge Springs High School.
Do you see like a direct line frequently with the social studies teacher being the coach? Or is it just me?
When I was in high school, our football coach was my science teacher, actually.
Okay.
Probably one of the worst teachers I ever had. He was the most boring teacher. He was not a good science teacher.
Oh, okay.
But the football players loved that guy.
Sure.
Anyway, Bud was a Republican and active in local politics. He was elected to the Pennsylvania House of Representatives in 1964 and reelected in 66 and 68. While still in office as a state rep, he went on the campaign trail to become a state senator. And when he won, he resigned his House position to be sworn in as a senator in January of 1971.
Okay.
He won two more terms as a state senator in Pennsylvania. And then in 1980, he campaigned for and won the office of Pennsylvania State Treasurer. Okay. And then he ran and won again in 1984. But things started to get a bit sticky. From 1971 to 1981, before Bud was state treasurer, public employees of Pennsylvania overpaid millions of dollars in Federal Insurance Contribution Act taxes, or FICA taxes. These are the taxes paid by both employee and employer to fund Social Security and Medicare. So these are the combined federal taxes taken out of your paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of this overpayment, the state required an accounting company to come in and determine refunds for its employees. So then Bud goes out to find a company that will do this work, and he chooses Computer Technology Associates, or CTA, at a cost of $4.6 million.
Okay, and this is before he's treasurer?
Well, the overpayments happened before.
I think they discovered
it after he was treasurer. So it became his responsibility, his department's responsibility to basically go back and audit this, figure out who's owed what, and like get the money back to people that it belongs to.
Got it.
So this is May of 1984 that he hires CTA on a contract for $4.6 million to do this work for the state of Pennsylvania. Then David Schatzman, who's the deputy comptroller of the Pittsburgh Public Schools, was looking at this contract and some things weren't adding up. So he contacts school district officials because he works for the public schools and he lets them know like, hey, something's not right here. And he also gets in touch with some peeps at an accounting firm, Arthur Young and Associates. And he says, hey, can you double check my work here?
And after, can I ask a quick question? And I'm really going to show my ignorance here. Why is an official with the school board reviewing a contract from state government?
I'm not exactly sure. He's a deputy comptroller. So he's part of the employees of the state.
Okay. Okay.
And his job is, as a comptroller, your job is to oversee finances.
Right. Okay.
And it's possible that because of that and the fact that he is a state employee, that he's one of these people that overpaid. And I'm positive this kind of stuff is like public information, right? Public record. So maybe he's just, you know, I'm not sure.
Okay. Okay.
So Arthur Young and Associates takes a look at it. And they confirm that shit's not adding up. And in fact, that the contract was way overpriced by millions of dollars. So about a month later in June of 84, the Office of the Pennsylvania Auditor General gave the old FBI a ringy dingy to let them know that there was probably some bribery going on here for this contract that CTA landed, which turns out was a no-bid contract. And the California-based company was owned by John Torquato Jr., a native of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And by late July, one Janice Kincaid, a former employee of CTA, had released a sworn statement claiming that Bud, our good friend Bud here, had awarded CTA the contract because he was promised a $300,000 kickback from the company.
Wow. And my understanding of, well, I should have a better understanding of government since I've worked in it for 20 years, but you have to put things out to bid. You don't just go hiring whomever.
Right.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
I'm surprised that it got this far.
So federal prosecutors are fully investigating this whole situation, right? Mm. And Bud runs off to pull the contract. Takes these backsies, he says. We're just going to pull it. And then Bud keeps trying to stop or divert or in some way forestall this federal investigation.
Mm-hmm.
He claimed the U.S. attorney had neither the authority nor the evidence to go anywhere with this line of inquiry. There was nothing he could prosecute here, wasting everyone's time.
Okay.
It would later come out, Bud even told his staff to withhold request for proposal information from the U.S. attorney and the FBI during their investigation.
Whoa.
But none of this kept Bud from being charged by a federal grand jury of agreeing to receive a kickback of $300,000 in return for awarding CTA the contract. Bud says he would take a polygraph, but only on the condition that if he passed, he would not be indicted.
That's literally not how this works, Bud. That's not how this works. Oh my God.
The state rejected this offer.
No shit.
Prior to Bud's indictment, a grand jury had indicted Torquato, his attorney, William Smith, and three others. Smith, a friend of Bud's, claimed at his trial that Torquato didn't bribe Bud. He only offered a campaign contribution to Bud in exchange for landing the contract, and Bud declined. But at Torquato's trial, Torquato testified that Smith made the bribe to Bud in return for the contract.
Torquato's just throwing him right under the bus. Right. People do that. Bus. People do that as soon as
they do
up shit creek. Yep.
100%. Budd, who testified on behalf of the defense in Smith's trial, denied he was offered anything at all in exchange for handing out the contract to CTA. Mm-hmm. But it's also confusing because Smith had a polygraph when he said he didn't bribe Budd, and somewhere between his indictment, Smith's indictment, and Smith's trial, he confessed somewhere to someone that the bribe had happened and Budd was into it.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, I met with Dwyer in his office and at the insistence of Torquato, offered to give him $300,000 if he signed a contract with CTA LTD. Dwyer talked about $100,000 to him personally, $100,000 to his campaign committee, $100,000 to Republican State Committee. Dwyer was going to see Robert Asher in Montgomery County that weekend to talk to him about how this should be done. Okay, apparently Bob Asher, who was at that time the Pennsylvania Republican Party chairman, objected to this, and he wanted that $300,000 to be directed entirely to the Republican State Committee, since he supposedly didn't want Budd to go to jail.
Okay. Wow.
Quote, Asher indicated that he had had a conversation with Mr. Dwyer, and he knew that I had made an offer to him of a $300,000 contribution, and then he was very angry when he began to talk about that, angry with me, said he thought I knew better than to offer a contribution to Mr. Dwyer, and he said if there was going to be a contribution, it was going to go to Republican State Committee.
Wow. This is some seedy shit.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
So then Budd and this Bob Asher guy are both indicted in May of 86. And Smith is trying to get his 12-year sentence reduced. So he testifies against them.
Mm-hmm.
He did not succeed in reducing his sentence. His wife did get immunity from prosecution. She was one of those other three that were indicted originally at the same time as Budd and Smith in the beginning.
Okay.
And all kinds of incriminating evidence came out in Budd's trial. There was a record of the bribe recovered from computer tapes seized from CTA. And beyond Smith's and Torquato's testimony, four other independent and impartial witnesses also testified to the bribe.
God.
And FBI agents found evidence that Budd had erased the entry in his appointment book of the meeting he had with Torquato where the bribe was first offered.
Like erased the pencil?
I mean, I guess. But, this is like the 80s, right? Like,
God. Yep. That doesn't exist anymore.
Never happened.
Nope. Wow. This guy.
At the end of the day, Budd awarded this contract to CTA, an obscure California company with three employees, very little equipment, and very little experience, even after Arthur Young and Associates, a Pennsylvania-based accounting company with 250 employees, had submitted a proposal for the contract 2 weeks before CTA did, stating they could perform the FICA recovery as fast as CTA for half the cost.
Fuck. Wow.
And the trial didn't even have to happen because the U.S. attorney prosecuting the case offered Budd a maximum 5-year sentence on one charge of bribery as long as he resigned from his office as treasurer and cooperated completely with the investigation.
That was the deal and he refused?
Budd said no.
Budd, come on. Because he thought he was like, they're not going to catch me. I fucking erased it. I'm going
to
trial.
He denied he did anything wrong, Amber.
Oh my God.
He did not testify at his trial, nor did his defense attorney call anyone on Budd's behalf, believing that the government didn't have a case.
They actually really do. This is not good. Okay.
Mm-hmm. There is speculation that Budd didn't take the stand because he was weary that questions about another shady dealing may have come up.
Oh.
Specifically, his involvement in a 1980 conspiracy that involved his wife's company and two Pennsylvania State Education Association employees. One of these PSEA employees was Budd's friend and his campaign manager, and both had been investigated for siphoning money from Budd's campaign and right into his personal bank account.
God, this guy sucks.
Budd's a shady dude.
Mm-hmm.
On December 18th, 1986, Bud was found guilty of 11 counts of conspiracy, mail fraud, perjury, and interstate transportation in aid of racketeering.
Fuck.
He could have just taken 5 years.
That plea was a Cadillac of a plea. And he was like, nope, idiot.
His sentence could be as much as 55 years in prison and a $300,000 fine.
Whoa.
And his co-defendant, buddy Bob Asher, was sentenced to 1 year in jail and later went back into politics and served as a Republican National Committeeman for Pennsylvania.
Of course he did.
Of course he did. According to Pennsylvania law, Bud didn't have to be officially dismissed from office until he was sentenced. His sentencing was scheduled for the end of January. So he took a leave of absence without pay while some deputy treasurer filled in for him. Of course, Bud planned to appeal and assumed he would win appeal and just go back to his position. So, like, why would he resign?
He is assuming a lot of things about how this is going to go down for him.
Okay. Yeah, he is. Bud continued to declare himself innocent and wrote a letter to both President Ronald Reagan asking for a presidential pardon and Senator Arlen Specter looking for help. Mm-hmm. In the final week of January 1987, just before Bud was scheduled for sentencing, the Pennsylvania State Attorney General and prosecutors were looking into the state constitution for a provision that basically said that if a civil worker was convicted of a crime, they would just basically be automatically dismissed from their position. They essentially wanted to get rid of Bud.
Yeah,
this leave of absence, he gets to step down on his own terms. Bullshit, right?
Yeah.
Like, can we just get rid of this guy?
No shit.
There was an expected decision on the interpretation of this clause in the Constitution on January 22nd, which was the day before Bud's sentencing hearing.
Mm.
Then Bud tells his press secretary that he wants to have a press conference.
No, Bud.
And his press secretary and his deputy treasurer are both at this meeting where he says this, and they're like, cool, cool. Yeah, you can do that, but don't be bashing the governor or talking about anyone involved in this case. Like, be cool, dude. And maybe do this somewhere, you know, neutral, like not at your office.
Mm-hmm.
And Bud's like, fucking, of course, I'm not going to talk about anyone involved in the case or say anything about anyone like bad or anything. But fuck off with this not at my office shit. Like, where else would I do it? I'm just going to thank my staff and my friends. No big.
Uh-oh. He goes rogue, huh?
So the two left Bud feeling okay. He wasn't going to say anything stupid. And the next day, Bud meets with his attorney to tell him he's going to have this press conference. And his attorney's like, dude, you got to show some remorse at this thing, man. You gotta. And so Bud agrees, and he's going to change his version of events to be, I don't know, more contrite or whatever. And this was the new version of events he was also going to present to the judge at his pre-sentencing hearing, which I'm guessing was to try to like sway the judge to give him the lightest sentence possible, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Bud tells his attorney that he will resign at this press conference, but he doesn't want his attorney to be there.
Okay.
Like a couple days later, Bud writes a letter to then Senator Joe Biden and Congressman Peter Rodino, and he tells them they need to do an investigation into this whole CTA affair and to reform the justice system in the U.S.
Okay.
Biden was then on the Senate Judiciary Committee and Rodino was on the House Judiciary Committee. And he told them that if they didn't do this, they needed to completely remove the word justice from anything related to the DOJ.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
There's no justice here, Amber.
No, no.
There's no justice here.
There's no I in team. There's no J in justice. Yep. It's just the DO. Sorry.
So finally, like a day or two before sentencing, Bud gets Arlen Specter on the phone. They talk for 8 or 10 minutes. He also wrote to Reagan again, asking for a pardon again. And Specter responded that Reagan couldn't pardon someone that was still in the middle of the legal process. Like, it wasn't done. That's not how pardons work. Okay.
So on the one hand, he's totally confident that he is not going to be convicted. But on the other hand, will you pardon my conviction?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then Bud pulls together his press conference. He tries to get his press secretary to exclude certain reporters that he thought were biased against him. But his press secretary was like, you can't use state government facilities to manipulate the free flow of information.
No.
Like, it's illegal. You can't cherry pick the news reporters who can and cannot be in government buildings for a press conference.
I'm concerned about how little this politician knows about the Constitution.
Right?
I am concerned.
You know what? I don't think Bud's an anomaly. Just
I know.
So the conference was scheduled for 10:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And everyone showed up and expected Bud to announce his resignation. That's what everyone expected to happen. Like, he was mm-hmm. going to announce his resignation at this press conference. There were 9 television cameras, 4 wire service photographers, and about 20 TV, radio, and newspaper reporters. Mm-hmm. Bud had a 21-page prepared statement.
Mm-hmm.
And aides handed out copies of the 20-page statement to everyone in attendance, with everyone assuming that the 21st page that they did not receive with their copies included Bud's resignation.
Okay.
Okay. Bud appeared nervous and agitated and started off right out the gate attacking the U.S. District Attorney, FBI agents, the U.S. District Court judge, the media, and a bunch of other people of, like, abusing the justice system and ruining him.
Mm-hmm.
He accused the district attorney of holding his trial in one of the most uneducated counties in the state.
Ouch. Okay.
That's why the jurors ruled the way they did, because they were.
Sure.
They were dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Then he spoke out against the death penalty and expressed regret for voting in favor of it when he was a part of the Pennsylvania Assembly.
Okay.
He went on for like half an hour. Mm-hmm. And about halfway through, some of the press started packing up to leave. And he said, quote, "Those of you who are putting your cameras away, I think you ought to stay because we're not finished yet."
Oh.
And then Bud got to the 21st page that no one else had. He told the room that his press secretary could make copies for everyone later. He read, mm-hmm. quote, "I thank the good Lord for giving me 47 years of exciting challenges, stimulating experiences, many happy occasions, and most of all, the finest wife and children any man could ever desire. Now my life has changed for no apparent reason. People who call and write are exasperated and feel helpless. They know I am innocent and want to help, but in this nation, the world's greatest democracy, there is nothing they can do to prevent me from being punished for a crime they know I did not commit. Some who have called have said I am a modern day Job." There's some more reference to the Bible for you today. Judge Muir is also noted for his medieval sentences. "I face a maximum sentence of 55 years in prison and a $300,000 fine for being innocent. Judge Muir has already told the press that he felt invigorated when we were found guilty and that he plans to imprison me as a deterrent to other public officials. But it wouldn't be a deterrent, because every public official who knows me knows that I am innocent. It wouldn't be legitimate punishment because I've done nothing wrong. Since I'm a victim of political persecution, my prison would simply be an American gulag." "I ask those that believe in me to continue to extend friendship and prayer to my family to work untiringly for the creation of a true justice system here in the United States and to press on with the efforts to vindicate me so that my family and their future families are not tainted by this injustice that has been perpetrated on me. Mm-hmm. We were confident that right and truth would prevail and I would be acquitted and we would devote the rest of our lives working to create a justice system here in the United States. The guilty verdict has strengthened that resolve, but as we've discussed our plans to expose the warts of our legal system, people have said, why bother? No one cares. You'll look foolish. 60 Minutes, 2020, the American Civil Liberties Union, Jack Anderson, and others have been publicizing cases like yours for years, and it doesn't bother anyone." Mm-hmm. And so now everyone is expecting him to say out loud that he resigns.
Right.
Instead, he hands out 3 manila envelopes to 3 of his staffers, 1 each, right? And then he pulled out another manila envelope, and from it, he removed a .357 Magnum revolver.
Oh.
Three reporters at the back of the room ran out to go look for cops. Everyone else in the room is gasping. Bud backs up against the wall behind him. He's holding the gun up, pointed towards the ceiling, close to his body. People are trying to, you know, talk him into handing it over, creeping close. And he's saying, don't. This could hurt someone. And he also says, please leave the room if this will affect you. And then he put the gun in his mouth and pulled the trigger.
Oh, my God.
Shot a bullet straight through his brain. Fell to the floor dead. Blood running out of the back of his head and his nose. 9 news cameras recorded it.
Oh, my God.
Only one station showed it live.
It was live?
It was live.
Oh, God.
A bunch of Pennsylvania stations broadcast taped footage to a midday audience.
They did?
Mm-hmm. None of the national newscasts showed the full tape. They all stopped it before he put the gun to his mouth.
How in the hell did that get passed? I understand if you're sort of, if you're alive and you can't help it, but how did it get broadcasted later that day? Like
they
that?
Chose to. They chose to.
My God.
Of the 3 manila envelopes Bud handed out before pulling out the gun, one was for the governor, one was an organ donor card and other related materials, and one was for his family, which included letters, one each for his wife and 2 children.
Mm.
The last paragraph on page 21 of his statement, Bud did not read out loud, and it said, quote, "I've repeatedly said that I'm not going to resign as state treasurer. After many hours of thought and meditation, I've made a decision that should not be an example to anyone because it is unique to my situation. Last May, I told you that after the trial, I would give you the story of the decade. To those of you who are shallow, the events of this morning will be that story. But to those of you with depth and concern, the real story will be what I hope and pray results from this morning. In the coming months and years, the development of a true justice system here in the United States. I am going to die in office in an effort to see if the shameful facts spread out in all their shame will not burn through our civic shamelessness and set fire to American pride. Please tell my story on every radio and television station and in every newspaper and magazine in the U.S. Please leave immediately if you have a weak stomach or mind, since I don't want to cause physical or mental distress. Joanne, Rob, Dee Dee, I love you. Thank you for making my life so happy. Goodbye to you all. On the count of 3, please make sure that the sacrifice of my life is not in vain."
Oh, my God.
And then the night before,
mm-hmm.
he took his life on TV. Bud wrote a note at home that said, "I enjoy being with Joe so much. The next 20 years or so would have been wonderful. Tomorrow is going to be so difficult, and I hope I can go through with it."
Oh.
And that is the story of our Bud Dwyer, who famously killed himself on live television.
That is fucking dark, sister. That is so dark.
You can still find that footage. It's famously made its way into Traces of Death in like the 90s on that one of those VHS tapes where it was like a compilation of like, you know, deaths caught on tape or whatever.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of music that is like inspired by, or like a bunch of bands have like put stuff about it in their music.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That song, "Hey Man, Nice Shot," is about him.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That is dark. Wow.
I mean, he was totally guilty.
The man was not
in his right mind.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't. And he was obviously very, very scared about his impending guilt.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, I get him saying like, I mean, please leave now if blah, blah, blah. But the fact is that did traumatize people.
100%.
You know,
apparently there was a snow day. So there were actually a lot of kids home from school that day.
Oh, God.
So like a bunch of kids did see it.
Yeah. Wow. Well, fuck. I don't even know what to say to that.
There's not a lot to be said.
I had a little bit of like, you know, this is like when we went and saw The Others and I had it figured out like, you know, an hour after you did. I started to realize which story you were telling me like a little while ago. And I stopped right after. I was like, I'm concerned that this politician doesn't know the Constitution. I was like, wait a minute. I think I know what happens at this press conference. And so I stopped making fun of him.
Oh,
because I had the guilties.
Oh, well, I mean,
I know
it's a pretty extreme response to avoiding consequences for bad decisions.
Yeah.
You know, and also it says a lot about like, even then, well, I mean, he was so full of hubris. He was so certain he didn't take that deal. Right. Mm-hmm. And also, clearly he knew that the fucking prison conditions in this country are fucking shitty and didn't want to go there.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the thing, too. I've that subject has come up like just with friends many times of people not giving a shit until it happens to them, you know?
Yeah.
And just not, I don't know. I don't know. Wow. It's still devastating. It's so devastating. I mean, fuck. It's so, oh, there's layers to this.
Yep.
Thanks, I guess. That was terrible.
Well, you know what? Touche, sister.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Your story was terrible, too.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. That's what we do to each other. Well, we did it. We got another one on the books. You guys, you know what to do. You know we're on all the things. X and TikTok and Facebook and Instagram. We have a website, crimeoneandchaos.com. If you want to, you know, send us a love letter for Amber or some hate mail for me, it's crimeoneandchaos@gmail.com. We love a rating. We love a rating on the app where you listen, especially if you've got one of those Apple products and can go like give us a typey-typey review. We love that.
Typey-typey.
That. And join the Patreon. Come hang out with us. We do virtual wine nights once in a while, and we have a bonus episode every month. And yeah, and Chaos Kids Club members get new episodes a day early. They drop on Saturdays. Right. So, get that perk, $5 a month.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm glad you could do that. I'm a little shooketh.
I'm sorry. Well, you know, I already knew what was going to happen. So I'm not as shooketh as you are.
Yeah. I'll get there.
That's okay. That's all right. Sister, yeah. I know that was fucking chaotic.
Fucking chaotic. Love you.
I love you. Bye.
Bye. Wine and Chaos is produced by 8th Direction Records. Artwork by Joshua M. Davis. Music by Paul Abner. If you would like to support the show, you can visit our Patreon page at crimewineandchaos.com/Patreon. Cheers.
Between like when you go